Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Neeskens, der jetzt in dieser Sekunde an der Gucci und Tor!
Good evening. Labour's overall majority looks like being 3. Mr. Wilson has called for a united country to beat the economic crisis.
Und jetzt läuft Reitan. Toll, schießt Tor!
Mr. Heath called on Labour to abandon what he described as divisive policy.
Weiter für Hölzenbein. Dirty Hawk. Jetzt im Strafraum. Jetzt kann es passieren. Die Nerven behalten. Und Jungblut hält.
Mr. Thorpe says the Liberals are not a spent force.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. This week with Jonathan and myself is David Winner, journalist and author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Football, and Those Feats, Essential History of English Football. And, of course, Dennis Bergkamp's biographer. David, lovely to have you on the show. This week we go back to the World Cup final in 1974. The Netherlands lost 2-1 to West Germany in Munich, of course. David, why have you chosen this match?
It's one of the key moments, not just my football life, but my life, because the feelings that that match left me with when I saw it at the age of 17, and it haunted me. It has haunted me to this day. And it led ultimately to me moving to Holland, writing Brilliant Orange, which was a success to my great surprise, and that changed my career, and it immersed me in the world of the Dutch. Living in the Netherlands for 4 years, eventually I met most of the players from that game, most of the Dutch ones anyway, and it was personally huge, and it was an extraordinarily emotional thing at the time. Because it's one of the great cliches of football, really, that the beautiful, brilliant, original Dutch of that World Cup got to the final and then blew it. Mm. And there were all sorts of feelings about it. At the time, I just saw it as a complete tragedy and almost a crime, which was how all the Dutch people saw it. As an adult, as really very adult, I'm now old, so I can look back and see that actually my teenage perception was quite skew-whiff in lots of ways.
Mm. I mean, it's perhaps one, in terms of where this game sits in football history, Jonathan, probably one of the biggest ones we've spoke about so far on these podcasts.
Yeah, and I think you have to remember as well what the World Cup was in those days, that the World Cup then was a lot bigger than it is now. Not in terms of a spectacle, not in terms of a number of people watching, not in terms of the amount of money it makes.
Completely agree.
But the Dutch sort of seized, certainly in Britain, seized the public imagination, you know, utterly. And yet, Ajax won the European Cup 3 years in a row. But those Ajax teams had not been seen in the same way because the European Cup had nothing like the profile of the World Cup. The World Cup was the event where everybody watched. You got a huge audience. And I guess 66, from an English point of view, had made that change, you know, far more significant. So this is really when the wider public, not just football nerds, wakes up to what total football is.
And also because England weren't playing in that World Cup, so we had nobody to root for. So
I guess you kind of had some interest in the Scots. They did their thing and went out gloriously in the group stage.
That was also quite a kind of tragic.
It was Scottish football, of course it was tragic.
It was one of those template tournaments, wasn't it? Everything subsequent was a repetition of it, which is how it was for the Dutch as well.
Yeah.
But I remember being quite emotional when the Scots went out and they played this game. Their third game was against Yugoslavia, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And Yugoslavia scored late and then Joe Jordan scored an equaliser. It's just, they just need one more goal in the last few seconds. And they didn't make it.
Yeah,
and
I mean, it wasn't quite as, I guess, those two threads crossed four years later.
Yeah.
For Scotland, it wasn't. Yeah. We're not here to talk about Scotland. Let's move on.
Sure. But the Dutch, of course, up until then, didn't really have any World Cup pedigree.
None at all.
The previous tournament they'd played in was 1938. And so often people can miss that. You think of the Netherlands as one of the great sort of international teams up there with you know, sort of Argentina and France and you know, one or two others. Or of course they haven't won the cup, but up until 1974 on the international stage hadn't done much in terms
of anything.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But I mean, they were on a par with, I don't know, Finland or something now.
Yeah,
they were completely disregarded. Uh-huh. Nobody knew who they were, didn't know any of their players. And that began to change a bit, but not wholly. Nobody sort of made the connection when Ajax won the European Cup 3 years running and Feyenoord, who'd beaten Celtic in 70 in the final. Again, that was a bit like Malmo winning it or something. It was a bit oddball.
Yeah. I mean,
who are these guys? Never heard of them.
I guess the early warning was when Ajax beat Liverpool, put five past them.
In 66. But that had been forgotten, I think.
And also Bill Shankly, you know, the great propagandist, sort of managed to make it out to be some kind of freak.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. They really were that good. Yeah.
But there was some weird circumstances. That game was played in fog and
it still counts in fog. You know,
absolutely. You know, a large number of people in the stadium had no idea what the score was because they couldn't see.
And a large number of people in Britain had no idea what the score was because European football wasn't taken that seriously.
But Shankly's point was, you know, it was a reasonable one at the time. Liverpool were, you know, that first great Liverpool team and will overturn it in the second leg, Shankly said.
And they didn't.
And they did not.
Was it 2-2 at Anfield?
2-2, yeah.
The Dutch only... Yeah, there's another world in which they didn't qualify for that tournament.
Yeah.
They came very, very close to the game against Belgium.
Well, you mean in 74? They shouldn't have been in the tournament because the final qualifying, they both won all their games against the other teams. But Holland had a better goal difference. And in the last minute of the last qualifying game in Amsterdam, I think it was, Belgium scored a perfectly good goal and was wrongly ruled offside. One of the great, if you talk to any Belgian, they still sort of go on about that.
One of the great sliding doors moments.
It really was. It really was. And then in 86, there was this kind of payback.
Yeah.
It was again an unfair sending off, and Belgium won it.
Let's not spend too much time on it. But what would have happened if the Netherlands hadn't qualified in 1974?
Cruyff would have played
in 1978. That's what I was just thinking.
Yeah,
they probably would have
won the World Cup by now.
Yeah, the template would not have been laid down.
Yeah, exactly.
And they may well have won it in 2010.
We would, in fact, be so fed up with the Dutch winning.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it is just as well they qualified for that tournament. Otherwise, the three of us would, you know, what would we talk about now?
They would be as annoying as Man City. I'd like
to distance myself from those comments.
But going into the tournament, David, what was the mood like in the Netherlands? Were they hopeful?
Yeah, I had no personal knowledge. I was in London.
Sure,
I was watching on TV. I gather that it was fairly lackadaisical.
Mm.
They didn't have any history in the tournament. It was a bit of a holiday. They didn't know what the team would do. there was no total football from the Dutch team until that tournament.
So it had
come from the Ajax team, which had then sort of broken up a bit because Cruyff had gone to Barcelona.
But
Bayern had won the European Cup that year. So it all seemed to be a bit broken, this great thing, mm-hmm. this great moment of four European Cups in a row. They weren't expecting... They knew they had good players, but they didn't know how they were going to play.
But it's funny though, isn't it, John? You think about it, that you think of like maybe Spain 2010, you know, the Barcelona, a lot of their players playing for that same team. Obviously, Real Madrid were very good. So the Spanish going into that tournament, okay, they were European champions as well. I take that point. But you're thinking, hang on a minute, we've got a side here. We've got some players. The Dutch maybe not...
But they were known. I mean, everybody outside Spain knew exactly who those guys were.
Well, true, but the Dutch having...
Do, and
but Ajax
seen them
having,
for
won, having won those European Cups... Surely that translates.
Cruyff had left in some acrimony, and it was only getting together for the tournament that, you know, they became friends again and played. When he'd left, it was quite a bitter break, and the team had got knocked out of the European Cup in the first or second round, by a Bulgarian team. I can't remember, and it all seemed to be over, and then they got it together, and Michels came in as coach, and then in a month of preparation, he drilled them to a level that the Feyenoord guys and Rensenbrink had never even seen before.
Mm.
And he taught them all how to play in a very short space of time in the Ajax way, but even better because of Van Hanegem and Rijsberg and, you know, these and Rensenbrink, these were all terrific players and probably a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
If Hulsoff, the defender, had played, they'd probably won the tournament because that was a loss. He'd been injured.
Right.
What if Blankenberg had taken Dutch citizenship as Cruyff wanted him to? How big a difference do you think that would have made?
I don't know him. Langenberg?
Blankenberg.
Oh, Blankenberg. Yes. Well, he didn't. But it would have been great.
Yeah.
You know, Blankenberg...
Because, I mean, he was obviously never going in the West Germany side.
That's
because
right, because of Blankenberg,
so.
Yeah. But he and Hulsoff were a fantastic combination.
Yeah.
I thought you said Langenberg. I'd never heard of him.
But it's funny what you say about Michels, because... That was one of the points that we were talking about when Andy Brassel was on the pod, when Ajax beat Panathinaikos 2-0 in the European Cup final, how when Michels left, a lot of the players thought, oh, thank goodness, that was draining.
Oh, no, they were relieved.
Yeah.
Pete Kaiser was said to have danced on the table.
So when he comes into the Dutch side, as you say, in that short space of time, whipped them into shape.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
In a very... if it had been, again, in a club context, it probably wouldn't have lasted. But because it was in this very short... short moment, it worked. And then in the final week, it falls apart. So there's, again, something I've... It's not me who discovered this. It was 2004. A friend of mine called Alka Kok, who's currently writing what is likely to be the definitive biography of Cruyff. He wrote a terrific myth-busting book, which was published simultaneously in Dutch and German, called 1974, We Were the Best. And it kind of demolished the Dutch idea that they'd been innocent victims of German skullduggery by telling the story of that week, well, of the tournament, but mostly that week before the final, where the Dutch discipline had gone. After they beat Brazil in what was...
Should we talk about the group and the two groups?
Sure,
and then we'll deal with the final week.
We'll leave. That's a bit of suspense.
Yeah, teaser. Stay with us.
a little peek behind the curtain and we're back on.
No flipping.
Yeah, well, the tournament, it was a 16-team tournament. Structure very different to what we know now, Jonathan, wasn't there? It was you had four groups that then went into two groups.
Yeah,
and the
top two go through, and the two groups of four, winners of those two groups play in the final.
Absolutely.
And the second team in each of those two groups plays in the third place playoff.
Yeah, and the Dutch en route to the final looked very good. They topped their first round group, of course.
Yeah, and what's remarkable, given the lack of expectation, or given the lack of history in international football, given that Michels has only just re-arrived, given all these doubts about, is this team actually any good?
Yeah.
That first game when they beat Uruguay 2-0 is so good that Sergio Macarian, who was a Uruguayan who at the time was working, I think, in some delivery company, he was a manager at a delivery company, and Sergio Macarian, watching that game back in Uruguay, was so struck by how far behind Uruguay, who obviously had won two World Cups, had fallen from, as he saw it, the best of Europe, that he quit his job, did a coaching qualification, and has since managed Paraguay and Peru.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
How old was he at the time?
He must have been mid-30s because he's 70 old now. So,
wow.
Blimey.
But yes. it did have, I mean, it was a revelation. And that game, the Uruguay game particularly, you look at, it's not boys against men. It's sort of aliens from a higher civilization against, you know, Stone Age man. It's so sophisticated what the Dutch are doing.
Yeah.
And this thing that they keep, they catch not just sort of one or two, but four, five, I think even possibly six Uruguayans offside.
Yeah,
with the pressing, these crazy high offside line.
How many of them were interfering with play, David? That's the question.
But I mean, this is...
And it's sensational, and the movement, and you can see the Uruguayans just looking bewildered.
Yeah, and people genuinely had no idea how to deal with this.
No clue.
And I know I've told this story before, but it bears retelling. So, you know, they go through the group, they beat Uruguay 2-0, draw 0-0 with Sweden, which of course is when Cruyff unveils the Cruyff turn, or he says it was spontaneous, it wasn't planned, but anyway, mm-hmm. weirdly...
That kind of move actually many, many times before.
Yeah, but that's when
camera angle. And
yeah.
That's when it was popularised, you'd
say. Yeah. And then they beat Bulgaria 4-1.
Yeah.
Then the second group phase, they hammer Argentina 4-0, beat East Germany 2-0, and then in a really brutal game, a game that they, you know, to get to the final, I think they needed a draw, didn't they, against Brazil?
Yes.
But they win it 2-0.
Ferocious fouling going on from both sides.
Yes.
Serbia started, the myth is that Holland started, the Brazil started, but it actually was Serbia, because Brazil were overrunning them in the first 15-20 minutes. And he fouled somebody and they had a fight and that kind of broke the Brazil rhythm.
Mourinho Perez, who was the Brazil captain, actually knocks Naiskens out. But I interviewed him back...
As in clean out?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, there's no concussion protocols. Mourinho Perez, the Brazil captain, knocks Naiskens out cold.
I didn't know he'd been knocked out cold. I remember Pereira getting sent off with a thigh high.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you think Naiskens had dived?
No, but I mean, they were going down like nine pins because the Brazilians just lost it.
Well,
and they were
evidently.
But crazy.
I interviewed Mourinho Perez a few years ago. And he, of course, that summer joined Barcelona as Naiskens also joins Barcelona.
Right.
And Barcelona managed by Rinus Michels.
Yes.
And with Cruyff already in the team.
Yeah.
So they seemed to get over that very quickly. But the thing that he said was he couldn't get his head around pressing at all.
Right.
In Brazil, playing at high offside line was known as the donkey line because they thought it was just so stupid.
Suicidal.
Because you could just chip a ball over the top and somebody would run on and score. Mm,
yeah.
What he didn't realise was that if you press at the right time, so you don't press when somebody already has the ball, you press when the ball has been played. And so by the time the ball reaches the recipient... He's surrounded by two or three players who are in his face. He's got no time to, you know, to measure the pass into the space. And he said getting to Barcelona and being taught to do that, which is completely alien to anything he'd been taught before, was a huge kind of culture shock to him. He said the first time he played the offside trap properly, he felt in training, he felt this great sense of pride. I used to look up and see Michel screaming at him going, no, no, go to the man with the ball. Don't stop halfway. But that's how radical it was.
Yes.
It's, you know, the captain of Brazil had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
He couldn't process in his own mind this idea of you would run not just 20 yards to play the offside, but another 20 yards to make sure the guy with the ball never had any time to measure the pass.
Yeah.
Well, and the pressing was not in a sort of scientific way like, you know, Klopp's teams do it, or every team tries now to do it. It was hurtling, you know, three, four men on the ball.
Well, and more. I mean, some clips where there's seven or eight of them.
Four or five, six. We'll go up to six.
Okay, we'll go up to six.
Six is my final offer.
It's still a lot. I think we're going to agree.
And it is. And you can see on the video and the video highlights, somebody did, you know, the birth of total football. Some videos from, it condensed it down to like 4 or 5 minutes about that Uruguay game. And there's sequences of four or five, top six, Dutchmen hurtling in on the guy. And if the first two, three wouldn't get him, the last one certainly would.
Yeah.
There was no way to escape it. And there was, because they had no idea, never seen this before, they didn't know to unload, you know, pass sideways or backwards. Those options weren't on.
Yeah.
So it was, they were overwhelmed. Mm. And when I, because last night I put myself through the torture of watching that final again. And what's striking is that they do almost none of that.
Yeah.
Right.
They barely get going.
Absolutely. Well, let's have a quick break, gentlemen, and after the break, we will talk about the final itself. Back in a minute.
Here comes the flanke, hoch vor das Tor. Nachschussmöglichkeit für Renzenbrink. Und Meier hält den Ball. Kreuz ist bei ihm und strittert wenig. nach gegen den Torwart. Das war nicht nötig, das war eine ziemlich harte Attacke.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Grabowski gefällt mir heute, sieht jetzt, dass Golov steil geht und kommt, ist der Ball bei Golov gelandet, im 16-Meter-Raum, Spitzerwinkel zum Tor, da kommt der Ball auf Müller, der dreht sich um die eigene Achse, schießt und Tor! Tor durch Gerd Müller!
Welcome back to Greatest Games, everybody. Now then, let's get to the final. So, the Dutch have been very impressive throughout the tournament, only conceded one goal, of course, en route to the final. They find themselves in the final. In Munich, against West Germany, and I suppose it's an obvious place to begin, and it's the first minute of the match. The first minute of that match, David, is one of the most extraordinary minutes of football you probably ever see.
Ever, yeah. I mean, people probably know it as well as I do. You know, Holland kick off,
yeah,
play keep ball, but I think it's 17 passes. I counted it up once.
It's so relaxed.
So relaxed, and the crowd are whistling. It's going on for about a minute. And the Germans are nowhere near the ball, and the crowd is going nuts. Very hostile crowd. Cruyff drops back. First he plays a side pass.
Mm-hmm.
Then it still doesn't go anywhere. Then he comes back again, picks it up, just goes on a darting little run.
Mm-hmm.
Just like he's going shopping. Just no effort in it at all. And he's gone past Bertie Vogts, who later in the game will kill him.
Mm.
But in that moment, he goes past him very easily and is fouled on the edge of the area. Penalty. Naiskin scores the penalty.
It's Uli Hoeneß who brings him down.
I think it is Hoeneß. Yeah.
It is Hoeneß, yeah.
And it's not actually in the penalty area. It's
right.
Just on the edge.
He deliberately brings him down, doesn't he, Jonathan? If you look at that foul again. I saw it. I thought it's very high and very late.
Oh, I think it's a foul, but I don't think it's inside the area.
Oh, I'm sure. That's definitely up for debate.
When Cruyff falls in the box, you can see why the referee would give it.
I mean, it's right on the line.
But if you watch that again, I'm quite convinced that Hoeneß has deliberately chopped him down.
So you think it's just sort of a sense of, God, we've had a ball for a minute. We've got to do something.
Yeah, perhaps. But watching that back...
Well,
that
he's through.
Yeah, he's through. And I think in those days, you could do that. As we saw,
you wouldn't get a red card.
Yeah, of course, yeah. You could certainly deploy those kind of tactics a little bit more freely than you could do nowadays. But it brings him down, and then penalties given, as you say. Naiskin smashes it in, and it's
going to be 6-0.
Exactly. It feels like he scored the seventh in a dead rubber in the first round against a poor side.
Yeah,
it's almost eerie.
Yes, and it's fatal.
Yeah,
and that's the kind of tragic that it's. It's a wound that can never be healed.
Yeah.
But do you think...
It's like, you know, Jimi Hendrix dying or...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Or Shelley drowning or, you know, James Dean crashing his car. It's a tragedy of the unfulfilled beauty. You know, because they completely relax at that moment. And
so do you think the 73 European Cup final, when they'd taken the early lead against Juve and then sat back and played keep ball and...
Yeah,
do you think that was in their heads?
I think it was. And I think even more relevant was...
Ajax had, sorry, I should make that clear.
Sorry, yeah, that was... sorry, we slip between the two, don't we? But Ajax had beaten Bayern 4-0 in the quarterfinal, I think it was, of the European Cup that year in Amsterdam very easily. And they had it in their mind after they'd beaten Brazil. We can beat the Germans, no problem. And the German players talk about in the tunnel, they had this fantastic arrogance feeling from the Dutch. You know, I forget which player says it. You know, he had the idea of, you know, the Dutch say, how much do you want to lose by today? They didn't say it, but that was the attitude.
Yeah.
And the first minute confirms all their superiority feelings.
Yeah.
And they, it should also, I mean, the stuff that I was going to come and tell you a bit earlier about Alcock's book, what he discovered. In
about that final week before the final.
Yeah, they were so unprofessional. Mm-hmm. They were living like rock stars. They were the famous story of the swimming pool.
Yeah.
Where the Rinus Michels did make it. It was complete propaganda. On page 17 or something of Bild Zeitung, the German equivalent of the Sun, but much less savage and untruthful than the Sun. You know, but in that context, it was sort of the yellow press had published a story, I think from a stringer, about naked girls swimming in the team hotel with some of the Dutch players, during the week. I can't remember even what the time it was, after the Brazil game, or before the Brazil. I think after, and it was not a big story. And nobody really picked it up. And Michels made a big, big thing of it, saying that, you know, it's a German conspiracy to try and undermine us. This is total irresponsible journalism. It's a total, total lie. All of this. And the players and the Dutch media all were sort of complicit in spreading this story, which was nonsense. Sorry, the denial was nonsense because actually...
So there's propaganda of it was propaganda.
But it was actually the story very much underplayed what had been going on because they were like rock stars. There were girls around there a lot, not just swimming in the pools, and some of the players were smoking. The discipline had gone. And bizarre, Michels had left to supervise Barcelona in the Spanish Cup final on something like the Wednesday.
So presumably Michels wouldn't have allowed that. I mean,
he wasn't there.
So that decision for him to leave...
But it's just kind of all the whole myth about, you know, they were preparing and they'd lost it because they thought they'd already won it by beating Brazil. That was the hard game for them.
But I mean, this
meanwhile, the Germans prepared in a magnificent way,
typical fashion. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, they were professional about it.
Yeah.
And the sort of key tactic during the game, as it turned out, was votes marking Cruyff. And he did, apart from the first minute, he was very effective at it. And Glanville, in his history of the World Cup, says he'd done the same thing to Cruyff in a youth tournament when they were kids. And that, but I didn't know that. But the story I heard was that there was a practice game on probably the same day that Michels was in Barcelona or Madrid or wherever the game was played. The Germans had a practice game in which Günter Netzer impersonated Cruyff very effectively. And votes, the whole system was to give votes the platform for marking Cruyff.
And votes was sort of renowned as a great man marker, wasn't he? Because he marked Kevin Keegan 77.
He was terrific at it.
Keegan actually gets the better of him, but.
Yes.
But he had a reputation as being the great man marker.
Yeah. Anyway, and then the first sort of half an hour of that, Netzer is beating him easily. And they'd stop the game, say, what's going wrong? What are you doing wrong? How about trying like this? So Netzer, who was at the level of Cruyff, who was the greatest player in the world at the time, was fit and didn't play in the final because Overath played. And that's a decision that kind of has ramifications for the whole of the development of German football because they went into the sort of machine football and percentages and fitness and fighting and all that, Kampfgeist. And so that's a pivot moment that they have Netzer fit, who'd been the star, the midfield star of that wonderful team 2 years.
When they'd beaten England at Wembley, the 3-1 in 72, he'd been the key to that game.
Fantastic player. And you know, his own man, you know, slightly rebellious kind of figure, like a George Best, like a Cruyff. Obviously, they're all different people, but he had that kind of pop star image. And the management didn't quite trust him. Schön preferred Overath. Anyway, they played this practice game and they perfected the marking plan and they put it into effect. And after this first sublime, extraordinary, otherworldly moment where the Dutch take the lead, in my memory and legend has it that the Dutch spend the next 20 minutes just making fun of the Germans. And I watched it last night thinking, hang on, it's not quite what happens.
No, it isn't.
The Germans fight back almost immediately.
Yeah.
They're really up for it.
Mm.
And they're pissed off.
Yeah.
And the Dutch are lackadaisical. And they don't get their passing going. They don't get their pressing going. When they do have the ball, they're sort of noodling around with it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time on that, they're just being pushed back. And in that first half, I don't think they have more than one shot on goal apart from the actual goal.
Yeah.
Johnny Rep near when it's 1-1.
I agree with you. Because in my mind, it's they go 1-0 up and then they take it easy and they're knocking it about. You're absolutely right.
And then suddenly the penalty changes the flow of the game. But that's not true. Not that.
And also another thing that I think people might, one can sort of think that Germany score two goals late on. All the goals come in the first half.
Yeah. Yes,
There's plenty of time.
Well, yeah. I mean,
turn this round.
Yeah, and Rep really should equalise. He has a great chance. But I mean, let's do the.
Sure.
No, it's not. It's actually 1-1.
Well, when he misses that chance, when there's a ball across the box and he's just...
You're thinking of two different chances, I think. Cruyff slips him in one point, but then there is another one.
He's coming in slightly from the side, but it's a chance these days would be a scandal if you miss it.
Yeah.
And he, instead of putting it to the far post or chipping or doing something that any striker would do now, he just plays it rather limply.
Yeah, we are talking about two different things. Yeah.
Well, okay. So
let's just deal with the German penalty.
Sure.
So in a sense, that starts with the immediate aftermath of a Dutch goal, where Beckenbauer famously says to the English referee Jack Taylor, as he gives the penalty,
"You're an Englishman."
Well, you're English. Yeah. You're an Englishman.
Yeah.
Because Beckenbauer,
it's a subtle bit of sledging.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, Beckenbauer, I mean, he's sort of been slightly found out with what happened at FIFA.
I was going to say, not the worst thing he's ever said, is it?
He's kind of there's a
worse was to come.
There's a cleverness about him in the worst sense of that word.
Yes.
Mm. That was largely sort of overshadowed by his image as a sort of gentleman of the game.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But he was
sly.
He was sly. Yeah.
A canny operator.
But you can see him on the tape. He sort of comes there and he sort of does a very un-English gesture of contempt for Taylor.
Right.
Sort of he doesn't just say, he sort of does that. I'm raising my arm in a kind of rude Bavarian way.
Even in the not that rude Bavarian.
Not that
rude.
Sure.
Even in that game in 72 at Wembley, there's an incident with the score at one. I know it must be early in the second half when. I can't remember who he is, an England player bursts into the left side of the box and is obviously fouled. And Beckenbauer straight in the referee's face saying it's a dive. It's not a dive, it's clearly a foul. But Beckenbauer sort of, whatever doubt was in the referee's mind, Beckenbauer managed to expand so that a really blatant penalty is not given.
Yes.
He was good at that.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I mean, he would sort of try and conduct the game in more than one way, wouldn't he, on the field, from his team's point of view, from the official point of view as well.
So the penalty has a reputation as being slightly controversial, but I really don't think it is.
In Holland, it's the defining, they call a dive a Schwalbe.
Right.
The German, the swallow. Mm-hmm. That is the German, and they say, we never do that, it's a German thing. And Holzenbein is absolutely fouled, but then he does... make a meal.
Yes. I mean,
Janssen catches him on his ankle.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, really, is
Well, in Holland, again, this was part of the great myth that we were cheated.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And this, the penalty and the dive, the Schwalbe, was the kind of the distillation of historic German evil against Holland. So it's like the invasion of 1940 and all the war crimes of Germany in the 40s during the Second World War and the Holocaust and all the and the hunger winter and all the humiliations. It was all in the Dutch imagination. It was sort of distilled into that moment. And the fact that Gerd Müller's, because he scored the winning goal a few, you know, 20 minutes later, his nickname was De Bomber.
Yeah.
You know, so he more or less personally destroyed Rotterdam and killed all those people. So in the, you know, the whole relationship that Dutch had with Germany and through that game, and it became this big, big national trauma because they'd never really talked much honestly about what had happened in the war. You know, this whole, you know, because the Dutch, there was lots of resistance people as well, but also an awful lot of collaboration. And there's a very complicated, messy, often very dark history, which Simon Cooper, for example, has written about very, very well. Ajax, the Dutch, the War, that book. So they're all projecting this onto this game, which is just inevitable. And a lot of people in England and around the world are doing the same thing. You know, the Dutch have the image of sort of the absolute good guys and the pure of heart and deed against the basically, nobody says it, but it's in the background. Oh, these Germans, they're basically, when they say efficient, they mean Nazi.
Sure.
So that you've got that whole, all that sort of psychodrama going on. And it's really catastrophically unfair to the players, to the German players.
Of course. They're
nothing to do with them.
Actually, it's a Breitner steps up to take the penalty. And I find the penalty quite odd the way it plays out, because the keeper obviously sort of...
He barely reacts.
He starts to go to his left, doesn't he? And Breitner's still about 3 yards from the ball. So Breitner sort of wanders up to the ball and strokes it in the other corner.
He just calmly side-foots it in the corner and raises his arms before the ball's even touched the net. Again, it looks a bit training ground.
Well, I think Jungblut had sort of just committed himself far too early and couldn't get back.
But he does pretty much the same for Müller's goal.
Yeah.
He just sort of doesn't react. He does make a couple of very good saves. He saves.
There's a really good save from Bertie Vogts.
Terrific from Vogts.
I do.
And also he pushes over. There's
over a free kick for Beckenbauer, chip free kick.
Yeah. Of course, one of the quirks of the side, of the Dutch side, was the goalkeeper's, what is he wearing, number 8?
Yes.
On his back? Because they did the numbering system differently, which back in those
days. But he's kind of the first sweeper keeper.
Yeah.
And he's explicitly in it, so kind of Cruyff and Meikle's come up with it together. They don't have a line keeper, partly because the best Dutch keeper of the time, a guy called Jan van Beveren, is absolutely a traditional line keeper, shot stopper, sort of dominates from corners and things like that. But he doesn't come out in the modern style. The modern style is kind of, you know, Manuel Neuer and every other goalkeeper you can think of now is kind of the descendant of Jungblut.
Uh-huh.
So he's picked in large part because he's like an extra sweeper. And he's good with his feet.
It's like having 11 outfield players almost.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But he's not that good with his
feet. Yeah, clearly.
Unfortunately. And in the other games, it didn't matter because.
Then, in one goal, they weren't.
Yeah, they weren't too much. Yeah. So Germany then kick on.
Well, yeah, 2 minutes before half time. Bonhoff, Rainer Bonhoff.
See, now I'm going to go into a post-traumatic stress.
Just put your fingers in your ears for the next 30 seconds or so.
We'll hold your hand through this moment then, David.
Cuts the ball back. And it's a strange goal, but it's also a goal that I think shows what Müller was so good at.
Oh, he's great from a striker's point of view.
His first touch, I must have watched this a dozen times last night to try and work out. Is his first touch takes him away from goal?
It looks like an absolute mistake, doesn't it?
So when you first see it, you think, oh, that's a really bad touch. But then he somehow manages to turn his body, you know, short, kind of slightly tubby man. So he's got this low centre of gravity.
Uses his backside
to kind of turn and drags it back across the keeper into the bottom corner. Great finish. The more I watch it, the more I think he played that deliberately to create space for himself.
But you see, Lewandowski's quite good at that, you know, in the more modern sort of reference, you know, sometimes having a touch away and then kind of wrapping his foot around it. I absolutely think he's done that deliberately.
Yeah, I've come to the conclusion he did.
Being a short, tubby striker myself, you know, and knowing that my touch wasn't that good.
And a legend.
Yeah, yeah. And hated by the Dutch. I do, because you think of Müller. I mean, that goal took him to, what, 14 World Cup goals, was it?
It took him to the record.
He overtook Just Fontaine.
Which obviously since been taken by Ronaldo.
It was...
And closer,
yeah. Mm.
I counted up his record in the biggest games you can play in, which I defined as World Cup and European Championship finals, semi-finals and quarter-finals and European Cup finals, Champions League finals. And he paid, I think, 14 of those. And his goal rate was 1.4 something.
Right.
And Maradona's in the same would be like 0.4. Yeah. And it's just uncannily
we've been talking a lot about misperceptions. I think he's slightly misremembered. We think of him as being just this poacher.
Oh, he was the
great. And he was a brilliant poacher. Mm. But, I mean, it's that game against England at Wembley that, where he really stands out of, he holds the ball up, he comes short for it. Yeah, yeah. He's a fantastic
centre forward. He's a magnificent
forward.
Player. Mm. And Breitner said to me that everything, because I did a piece about Müller and I called him and it was kind of a bit through gritted teeth because memory of 74. And he said a very generous and loving thing that he said, you know, all the success we had, everything, my whole career, you know, all the things we won, European Cups, the World Cup, the European Championship, all of my success was not down to Beckenbauer, not down to anybody else, not down to Zett Meyer. It was all Müller.
If Beckenbauer hadn't been there, Blankenberg would have played for
that's
them.
That's right.
So.
No, they'd have been right.
Yeah.
He wasn't quite as good as Beckenbauer, but he was good. He was good. Mm. And he said, you know, Müller was extraordinary. Whatever number of goals we needed, he would get them.
Yeah.
And he said it didn't matter what tactics we played. If Müller was playing, we'd win. If he wasn't playing, we wouldn't win.
Yeah, I mean, who was it? So, what, Jupp Heynckes was his backup, was it? Or?
I guess. He a bit younger?
Well, Heynckes on the bench in this final, so.
So, Müller kind of was partner and then replaced Duvizela.
Yeah.
So, in 70, they were a fabulous double act.
And then Rummenigge comes in towards the end of the decade.
And then later, yeah. So, and I guess Heynckes would have been. Fischer was much later, wasn't he?
Fischer was certainly there in 82, so.
David, when Müller scored that goal in 74 final, am I right saying the Dutch commentator uttered the words?
They tricked us again.
Yeah, we are fooled again.
They tricked us again.
Right. Okay. It became a bit of a catchphrase.
It was. It was like a sort of, you know, Kenneth Wollstoneham. They think that thing.
Yeah.
It's
that.
It's up for grabs now. It's one of those iconic.
Yeah.
Moments of commentary, and what that meant was the war.
Right.
You know, they said, you know, we were neutral. They said they wouldn't invade, and then they invaded.
And that shows you how
and
much.
I spoke to Kauphoff about it. He said, no, I didn't mean that. I just meant in the football sense. But nobody really? Took it that way.
Well, yeah, they hadn't played that many times then, had they?
No, well, they had. There was a game in the 50s where, against all expectations, amateur Dutch team won.
So
and that was.
So they weren't filmed, yeah.
So, well, but I mean, it wasn't in a World Cup. It was just a friendly game.
Okay.
But that was very emotional for those who
sure.
saw it.
So Germany 2-1 up. And as we say, the Dutch. I mean, Germany, the German chance, they still had a few chances themselves, but the Dutch had chances, Jonathan, the one that you alluded to earlier.
Well, I think there's
well,
three.
Well, the second half is a different story.
Yeah, but I think there's three really good
so
chances.
So they go off, Cruyff gets booked because he's arguing.
Oh, that's
with,
right, yeah.
It's half time. The whistle has gone. They're all walking off and he's picking a fight with Taylor.
Yeah.
And he gets himself booked. Just, he was not at the races. His head was elsewhere. Nobody knows why.
Mm.
The biggest game of his life and he screwed it up.
Yeah. Yeah,
and partly you know the good play of Bertie Vogts, but he's not doing any of the normal things that Cruyff would do.
Mm.
It's extraordinary. Again, watching it, it's like there's no runs. He drops deep sometimes to pick up the ball, and then gives a little 5-yard pass to one of the defenders. I mean, it's not normal what he's doing. No, almost no. Apart from the first minute, almost no good runs. He's not directing traffic in any interesting way. It's really a terrible game he's having.
Yeah, and in the second half,
well, I'd say three really good Dutch chances. So there's the corner that Meyer gets his punch horribly wrong,
mm-hmm.
and Breitner clears it off the line.
Heads it off the line, yeah.
And then the one that I have to say I'd completely missed until I watched the game back in the last couple of days, when there's a ball to the back post from Van der Kerkhoff,
and Neeskens comes in
on pretty much exactly the blade of grass where Marco van Basten scores the volley from in 88.
Yes.
He smashes the volley.
He actually
right
smashes the volley, but
it's slightly nearer in.
Slightly closer in.
But it's a.
But smashes it straight at Meyer.
Yeah.
And Meyer. Still a great reaction save to push the ball away.
Sure. Yeah. Because he hits it with incredible force.
Yeah. I mean, one of those. Yeah. Van Basten sort of slightly cuts across it, which is what gives it the loop and dip.
Yeah.
Which takes it over Dasayev in the 88 European Championship final. But I was sort of. It was one of those things where I was sort of, you know, had the game on, was sort of my intentions started to drift. And part of me is like, oh, hang on, have I gone to a different... Is this flicked forward somehow?
Time slip.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the chance that...
I'd never made that connection before.
Right, but it's almost... Right. You're right, it's sort of 6 yards closer in, 6 feet closer in, but...
Yeah, but it's notes. It's the same thing. And again, from the left, it's across from the left.
Yeah.
There was Van de Kerkhoff.
Rather than Muren, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the great chance of Rep has that there's a... I think, is it... There's a Van de Kerkhoff again, gets down the right, pulls across.
Ball slid across, yeah.
Across.
Oh, that's right, and he just misses it.
And he's six yards out, gets the touch, and it goes across 2-3 feet wide of the far post.
Uh-huh. I'm not sure he even touches it, actually, but
I
think he gets something on it.
Yeah, I think...
He might be at full stretch, but he gets something on it. But you know, time...
Well, there's a Van Hanegem has a... He's just sort of wrong. It's a header, a diving header, and he heads it straight
down.
Right,
that's right, yeah.
Pace off. Not that there's much pace anyway, and it's a very simple...
Oh, it just loops up, and yeah. And
there's another one where Rennie van der Kerkhoff has a terrific chance, and he just... It barely goes for a goal kick.
Yeah.
But use it right wide.
But time runs out.
And time runs out. And again, the pattern of play, sort of, for the first 20 minutes or so of the second half, the Dutch are playing properly.
Yeah.
And the Germans are getting worried. But they also break away, and Muller scores another goal, which is wrongly disallowed.
Yeah.
And there's another penalty that they could have, where Holzenbein again gets fouled or pushed or something by Janssen again.
It did look like a foul to me, I have to say.
Yeah, it could have been 4-1.
Yeah, goodness knows what Beckenbauer was saying at the other end, but my goodness, we can imagine. But the game finishes, the West Germans win, and the anti-German feeling among the Dutch grows and grows, because this is one of football's great rivalries.
This is really... On that day.
In terms of just football, this is where it's really sort of born.
Yes.
And, I mean, you know, as you say, there's a lot of anti-German sentiment anyway, because of World War II, blah, 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 blah.
But it's all kind of repressed.
Yeah.
So nobody says it directly.
Mm.
But it's absolutely soaked into every...
Mm.
Fragment of Dutch being.
Yeah.
That, you know, they were cheated. Mm-hmm. Bloody Germans, basically like Nazis, but wearing white shirts. And, you know, the whole thing gets... It just boils away for decades. And I think it's they've sort of... They've come to terms with it. I've certainly come to terms with it in a way that I thought I never would.
Do you think Euro 88 helped?
It did, but it
obviously
wasn't...
Obviously beating Germany in the semi-final on their own soil and then winning the trophy in that stadium.
In Munich. But at the time, it was the best thing that had ever happened, and bigger street parties. The whole nation came out onto the streets in 88 when they went in. It was a weird, exact mirror image of, in the scoring, you know, a penalty, a dodgy penalty, and the German one is probably a penalty, and the Dutch one really... Uh-huh. The referee should never give it when Van Basten goes down, but he gives it, and Koeman scores. So, and then in the last, a sliding across from right to the goalkeeper's right to left, very slowly going into the corner, like
the Van Basten winner.
The Van Basten's winning goal in 88 is like, you know, it's really uncanny echo of the Muller goal. And again, you know, the greatest centre forward of the day.
Yeah. I was out in Hamburg,
Am I right in saying that did Ronald Koeman sort of...
He did. Yes, I know exactly what you're going to say.
I'll say it if you don't, David. Yeah, so he showed
his,
you.
His good mate, he swapped shirts at the end of the game with his mate, Olaf Toon.
Yeah.
And then he mimes wiping his ass with it at the end of the game. And it's a horrible moment, actually.
Uh-huh.
Because even less in 88 do the German players deserve to be considered sort of ersatz. Nazis.
Yeah.
They didn't deserve it in 74.
No,
they certainly didn't in 88.
Right enough,
But by then, the Dutch kind of neurosis about all this had developed to such a degree where they felt free. I mean, Koeman's not born anywhere near the war.
Yeah.
He feels, and there's this sort of tremendous self-righteous prejudice towards the Germans. So in Amsterdam at that time, it's very fashionable if German tourists who would come across the border for the dope cafes, you know, the cannabis cafes. And it was a popular day. If they asked for the Central Station, you send them to the Rijksmuseum.
Yeah.
You know, you would take pride in it.
Right.
As if you were a resistance fighter. Again, Simon Cooper's written very well about this.
Incredible.
And meanwhile, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, through the 90s, and since, first of all, the Dutch intellectuals are going, hang on, this is a bit, this is not true. And Lou de Jong, the great historian, writes a book, which actually it's on English television, The World at War, about the war in the Netherlands. It's very much informed by Lou de Jong's analysis, which is much more about the collaboration and so on. It's a it's an uncomfortable period, you know. And the story of Anne Frank, you know, she's betrayed, arrested, and deported by Dutch officials. You know, it's a much more nuanced, is the polite way of saying it, but it's, you know, it's a difficult history.
Absolutely.
And, and projecting all this sort of simple black and white stuff onto this football game wasn't really fair, but of course it gives it this incredible cultural, emotional, tribal weight.
Absolutely. David, it's been fascinating talking to you about this game. One of the most incredible games in the history of football, I think we can agree. Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure. There we are, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. For more stories like this, do check out The Blizzard, of course. We're back next week with another great game from the history of football. We'll see you then.
Was a Stakhanov production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.